The framework as utopian common ground. The use of a filter device dependent upon people's individual decisions to live in or leave particular communities is especially appropriate, for the ultimate purpose of utopian construction is to get communities that people will want to live in and will choose voluntarily to live in, or at least this must be a side effect of successful utopian construction. The filtering process proposed will achieve this. Furthermore, a filtering device dependent upon people's decisions has certain advantages over one which operates mechanically, given our inability to formulate explicitly principles which adequately handle, in advance, all of the complex, multifarious situations which arise. We often state prima facie principles without thinking that we can mark off in advance all of the exceptions to the principle. But though we cannot describe in advance all of the exceptions to the principle, we do think that very often we will be able to recognize that a particular situation we are presented with is an exception. Similarly, we will not be able in advance to program automatically a filtering device to reject all and only what should be rejected, either objectively or in our view now or in our view then. We will have to leave room for people's judging each particular instance. This is not by itself an argument for each person's judging for himself, nor is the only alternative to the mechanical application of explicitly formulated rules the operation of a system wholly dependent upon choices without any guidelines at all, as it is clear from the existence of our legal system. So the fact of not being able to state or program exceptionless principles in advance does not, by itself, suffice to get to my preferred alternative of everyone's choice, and no guidelines set up in advance, except for those guidelines that protect this preferred argument. We have argued that even if there is one kind of community that is best for each and every person, the framework set out is the best means for finding out the nature of that community. Many more arguments can and should be offered for the view that, even if there is one kind of society that is best for everyone, the operation of the framework, one, is best for anyone's coming up with a picture of what the society is like, two, is best for anyone's becoming convinced that the picture is indeed one of the best society, three, is best for large numbers of people's becoming so convinced, and four, is the best way to stabilize such a society with people living securely and enduringly under that particular pattern. I cannot offer these other arguments here, and I could not offer all of them anywhere, understanding why supports the correctness of the position. However, I do wish to note that the arguments for the framework offered and mentioned here are even more potent when we drop the false assumption that there is one kind of society best for everyone, and so stop misconstruing the problem as one of which one type of community every individual person should live in. The framework has two advantages over every other kind of description of utopia. First, it will be acceptable to almost every utopian at some future point in time, whatever his particular vision. And second, it is compatible with the realization of almost all particular utopian visions, though it does not guarantee the realization or universal triumph of any particular utopian vision. I say almost every utopian and almost all particular utopian visions because it is unacceptable to and incompatible with utopians of force and dominance. Any utopian will agree that our framework is an appropriate one for a society of good men. For good men, he thinks, voluntarily will choose to live under the particular pattern he favors, if they are as rational as he is, and thus are able equally to see its excellence. And most utopians will agree that at some point in time, our framework is an appropriate one, for at some point, after people have been made good, and uncorrupt generations have been produced, people voluntarily will choose to live under the favored pattern. Thus, our framework is now admitted, among a wide range of utopians and their opponents, to be appropriate common ground sooner or later, for each thinks his own particular vision would be realized under it. I say most utopians because of the following possible position. 1. Pattern P is best, not only for uncorrupt persons, but also for corrupt ones. 2. However, corrupt ones would not choose voluntarily to live under pattern P. 3. Furthermore, it's an unfortunate empirical fact that there is no way to get to uncorrupt people starting from us and our society. 4. So we can never get to a situation of most people wanting to live under pattern P. 5. Therefore, since P is the best pattern for all, corrupt or not, it will have, continually and eternally, to be imposed. Those with different utopian visions who believe the framework is an appropriate path to their vision, as well as being permissible after their vision is realized, might well cooperate in attempting to realize the framework, even given mutual knowledge of their different predictions and predilections. Their different hopes conflict only if they involve universal realization of one particular pattern. We may distinguish three utopian positions: imperialistic utopianism, which countenances the forcing of everyone into one pattern of community; missionary utopianism, which hopes to persuade or convince everyone to live in one particular kind of community, but will not force them to do so; and existential utopianism, which hopes that a particular pattern of community will exist, will be viable, though not necessarily universally, so that those who wish to do so may live in accordance with it. Existential utopians can wholeheartedly support the framework. With full knowledge of their differences, adherents of diverse visions may cooperate in realizing the framework. Missionary utopians, though their aspirations are universal, will join them in supporting the framework, viewing fully voluntary adherence to their preferred pattern as crucial. They will not, however, especially admire the framework's additional virtue of allowing the simultaneous realization of many diverse possibilities. Imperialistic utopians, on the other hand, will oppose the framework so long as some others do not agree with them. Well, you can't satisfy everybody, especially if there are those who will be dissatisfied unless not everybody is satisfied. Since any particular community may be established within the framework, it is compatible with all particular utopian visions, while guaranteeing none. Utopians should view this as an enormous virtue, for their particular view would not fare as well under utopian schemes other than their own. Community and Nation. The operation of the framework has many of the virtues and few of the defects people find in the libertarian vision. For though there is great liberty to choose among communities, many particular communities internally may have restrictions unjustifiable on libertarian grounds. That is, restrictions which libertarians would condemn if they were enforced by a central state apparatus. For example, paternalistic intervention into people's lives, restrictions on the range of books which may circulate in the community, limitations on the kinds of sexual behavior, and so on. But this is merely another way of pointing out that, in a free society, people may contract into various restrictions which the government may not legitimately impose upon them. Though the framework is libertarian and laissez-faire, individual communities within it need not be, and perhaps no community within it will choose to be so. Thus, the characteristics of the framework need not pervade the individual communities. In this laissez-faire system, it could turn out that though they are permitted, there are no actually functioning capitalist institutions, or that some communities have them and others don't, or some communities have some of them, or what you will. It is strange that many young people, in tune with nature and hoping to go with the flow and not force things against their natural bent, should be attracted to statist views and socialism, and are antagonistic to equilibrium and invisible hand processes. In previous chapters, we have spoken of a person's opting out of particular provisions of certain arrangements. Why now do we say that various restrictions may be imposed in a particular community? Mustn't the community allow its members to opt out of these restrictions? No. Founders and members of a small communist community may, quite properly, refuse to allow anyone to opt out of equal sharing, even though it would be possible to arrange this. It is not a general principle that every community or group must allow internal opting out when that is feasible, for sometimes such internal opting out would itself change the character of the group from that desired. Herein lies an interesting theoretical problem. A nation or protective agency may not compel redistribution between one community and another, yet a community such as a kibbutz may redistribute within itself or give to another community or to outside individuals. Such a community needn't offer its members an opportunity to opt out of these arrangements while remaining a member of the community. Yet, I have argued, a nation should offer this opportunity. People have a right to so opt out of a nation's requirements. Wherein lies the difference between a community and a nation that makes the difference in the legitimacy of imposing a certain pattern upon all of its members? A person will swallow the imperfections of a package P, which may be a protective arrangement, a consumer good, a community, that is desirable on the whole, rather than purchase a different package, a completely different package, or P with some changes, when no more desirable, attainable different package is worth to him its greater costs over P, including the costs of inducing enough others to participate in making the alternative package. One assumes that the cost calculation for nations is such as to permit internal opting out. But this is not the whole story, for two reasons. First, it may be feasible in individual communities also to arrange internal opting out at little administrative cost, which he may be willing to pay, yet this needn't always be done. Second, nations differ from other packages in that the individual himself isn't to bear the administrative costs of opting out of some otherwise compulsory provision. The other people must pay for finally designing their compulsory arrangements so that they don't apply to those who wish to opt out. Nor is the difference merely a matter of there being many alternative kinds of communities while there are many fewer nations. Even if almost everyone wished to live in a communist community, so that there weren't any viable non-communist communities, no particular community need also, though it is to be hoped that one would, allow a resident individual to opt out of their sharing arrangement. The recalcitrant individual has no alternative but to conform. Still, the others do not force him to conform, and his rights are not violated. He has no right that the others cooperate in making his nonconformity feasible. The difference seems to me to reside in the difference between a face-to-face community and a nation. In a nation, one knows that there are nonconforming individuals, but one need not be directly confronted by these individuals or by the fact of their nonconformity. Even if one finds it offensive that others do not conform, even if the knowledge that there exist nonconformists rankles and makes one very unhappy, this does not constitute being harmed by the others or having one's rights violated. Whereas in a face-to-face community, one cannot avoid being directly confronted with what one finds to be offensive. How one lives in one's immediate environment is affected. This distinction between a face-to-face community and one that is not generally runs parallel to another distinction. A face-to-face community can exist on land jointly owned by its members, whereas the land of a nation is not so held. The community will be entitled then as a body to determine what regulations are to be obeyed on its land, whereas the citizens of a nation do not jointly own its land, and so cannot in this way regulate its use. If all the separate individuals who own land coordinate their actions in imposing a common regulation, for example, no one may reside on this land who does not contribute 10% of his income to the poor, the same effect will be achieved as if the nation had passed legislation requiring this. But since unanimity is only as strong as its weakest link, even with the use of secondary boycotts, which are perfectly legitimate, it would be impossible to maintain such a unanimous coalition in the face of the blandishments to some to defect. But some face-to-face communities will not be situated on jointly held land. May the majority of the voters in a small village pass an ordinance against things that they find offensive being done on the public streets? May they legislate against nudity or fornication or sadism on consenting masochists, or hand-holding by racially mixed couples on the streets. Any private owner can regulate his premises as he chooses, but what of the public thoroughfares where people cannot easily avoid sights they find offensive? Must the vast majority cloister themselves against the offensive minority? If the majority may determine the limits on detectable behavior in public, may they, in addition to requiring that no one appear in public without wearing clothing, also require that no one appear in public without wearing a badge certifying that he has contributed 10% of his income to the needy during the year, on the grounds that they find it offensive to look at someone not wearing this badge, not having contributed? And whence this emergent right of the majority to decide? Or are there to be no public place or ways? Some dangers of this, noted in Chapter 2, would be avoided by the Lockean proviso of Chapter 7. Since I do not see my way clearly through these issues, I raise them here only to leave them. Communities which change. The individual communities may have any character compatible with the operation of the framework. If a person finds the character of a particular community uncongenial, he needn't choose to live in it. This is all well and good for an individual deciding which community to enter. But suppose a particular community is changing in its character and becoming one of a sort an individual dislikes. If you don't like it here, don't join, has more force than, if you don't like it here, leave. After a person has spent much of his life in a community, sent down roots, made friends, and contributed to the community, the choice to pick up and leave is a difficult one. Such a community is establishing a new restriction or abolishing an old one, or seriously changing its character, will affect its individual members in something like the way in which a nation's changing its laws will affect its citizens. Shouldn't one, therefore, be less willing to grant the communities such great latitude in ordering their internal affairs? Shouldn't there be limits on their imposing restrictions that, if imposed by a state, would constitute a violation of an individual's rights? Friends of Liberty never thought that the existence of America made legitimate the practices of Tsarist Russia. Why should there be a difference of kind in the case of the communities? Various remedies suggest themselves. I shall discuss one here. Anyone may start any sort of new community compatible with the operation of the framework they wish, for no one need enter it. No community may be excluded on paternalistic grounds, nor may lesser paternalistic restrictions geared to nullify supposed defects in people's decision processes be imposed. For example, compulsory information programs, waiting periods. Modifying an already existing community is held to be a different matter. The wider society may pick some preferred internal structure for communities, which respect certain rights and so on, and may require that communities somehow compensate the community's dissenters for changes away from this structure, for those changes it chooses to make. Having described this solution to the problem, we see that it is unnecessary. For to accomplish the same end, individuals need only include in the explicit terms of an agreement, contract, with any community they enter, the stipulation that any member, including themselves, will be so compensated for deviations from a specified structure, which need not be society's preferred norm, in accordance with specified conditions. One may use the compensation to finance leaving the community. Total communities. Under the framework, there will be groups and communities covering all aspects of life, though limited in membership. Not everyone, I assume, will choose to join one big commune or federation of communes. Some things about some aspects of life extend to everyone. For example, everyone has various rights that may not be violated, various boundaries that may not be crossed without another's consent. Some people will find this covering of all aspects of some persons' lives and some aspects of all persons' lives to be insufficient. These people will desire a doubly total relationship that covers all people and all aspects of their lives. For example, all people in all their behavior, none is excluded in principle, showing certain feelings of love, affection, willingness to help others, all being engaged together in some common and important task. Consider the members of a basketball team, all caught up in playing basketball well. Ignore the fact that they are trying to win, though is it an accident that such feelings often arise when some unite against others? They do not play primarily for money. They have a primary joint goal, and each subordinates himself to achieving this common goal, scoring fewer points himself than he otherwise might. If all are tied together by joint participation in an activity toward a common goal that each ranks as his most important goal, then fraternal feeling will flourish. They will be united and unselfish. They will be one. But basketball players, of course, do not have a common highest goal. They have separate families and lives. Still, we might imagine a society in which all work together to achieve a common highest goal. Under the framework, any group of persons can so coalesce, form a movement, and so forth. But the structure itself is diverse. It does not itself provide or guarantee that there will be any common goal that all pursue jointly. It is borne in upon one, in contemplating such an issue, how appropriate it is to speak of individualism and, the word coined in opposition to it, socialism. It goes without saying that any persons may attempt to unite kindred spirits, but, whatever their hopes and longings, none have the right to impose their vision of unity upon the rest. Utopian means and ends. How do the well-known objections to utopianism apply to the conception presented here? Many criticisms focus upon utopians' lack of discussion of means for achieving their vision, or their concentration upon means that will not achieve their ends. In particular, critics contend that utopians often believe that they can bring about new conditions and nurture forth their particular communities by voluntary actions within the existing structure of society. They believe this for three reasons. First, because they believe that when certain persons or groups have an interest in the continuance of a pattern far from the ideal one, because they occupy a privileged position in it and benefit from specific injustices or defects in the actual pattern which would be eliminated in the ideal one, then if their cooperation is necessary in order to realize the ideal pattern through voluntary actions, these people can be convinced voluntarily to perform the actions against their interests, which will aid in bringing about the ideal patterns. Through argument and other rational means, utopians hope to convince people of the desirability and justice of the ideal pattern, and of the injustice and unfairness of their special privileges, thereby getting them to act differently. Second, their critics continue, utopians believe that even when the framework of the existing society allows joint voluntary actions that would be sufficient to bring about a great change in the society by those not benefiting from defects and injustices in the actual society, then those whose privileges are threatened will not intervene actively, violently, and coercively to crush the experiment and changes. Third, critics assert that utopians are naive to think, even when the cooperation of the especially privileged is not required, and when such persons will abstain from violently interfering in the process, that it is possible to establish through voluntary cooperation the particular experiment in the very different external environment which is often hostile to the goals of the experiment. How can small communities overcome the whole thrust of the society? Aren't isolated experiments doomed to failure? On this last point, we saw in Chapter 8 how a worker-controlled factory could be established in a free society. The point generalizes. There is a means of realizing various micro-situations through the voluntary actions of persons in a free society. Whether people will choose to perform those actions is another matter. Yet, in a free system, any large, popular, revolutionary movement should be able to bring about its ends by such a voluntary process. As more and more people see how it works, more and more will wish to participate in or support it. And so it will grow, without being necessary to force everyone, or a majority, or anyone into the pattern. There remains a reason why, though permitted, possible of success and not aggressively interfered with by the actions of hostile persons, the experiment taking place in the different external environment might not have a fair chance to survive. For if the whole society does not have a voluntary framework, then there might be an experiment, which is in a voluntary corner of the total actual framework, that would succeed in a wholly voluntary framework, but won't succeed in the actual one. For in the actual one, while no one is forbidden to perform any action strictly necessary to the success of the experiment, it might be that some illegitimate prohibition on other actions makes people less likely, ranging to extremely low probability, to perform the voluntary actions comprising the success of the experiment. To take an extreme example, anyone in a certain group might be permitted to hold a certain job, yet everyone might be forbidden to teach them the skills used on the job, certification of such skills being the only feasible way to hold the job, though some other extremely difficult route is left open. Even if none of these objections hold, some will object to the reliance on the voluntary actions of persons, holding that people are now so corrupt that they will not choose to cooperate voluntarily with experiments to establish justice, virtue, and the good life, even though if they did choose to do so, the experiments would succeed in a wholly voluntary environment or in some current one. Furthermore, if they weren't corrupt, after they're not corrupt, they will cooperate. So, the argument continues, people must be forced to act in accordance with the good pattern, and persons trying to lead them along the bad old ways must be silenced. This view deserves an extended discussion, which it cannot be given here. Since the proponents of this view are themselves so obviously fallible, presumably few will choose to give them, or allow them to have, the dictatorial powers necessary for stamping out views they think are corrupt. What is desired is an organization of society optimal for people who are far less than ideal, optimal also for much better people, and which is such that living under such organization itself tends to make people better and more ideal. Believing with Tocqueville that it is only by being free that people will come to develop and exercise the virtues, capacities, responsibilities, and judgments appropriate to free men, that being free encourages such development, and that current people are not close to being so sunken in corruption as possibly to constitute an extreme exception to this, the voluntary framework is the appropriate one to settle upon. Whatever the justice of these criticisms of the views about means of writers in the utopian tradition, we make no assumption that people can be gotten voluntarily to give up privileged positions based on illegitimate interventions, directly or through government, into other people's lives. Nor do we assume that, in the face of the permissible voluntary actions of persons refusing any longer to have their rights violated, those other persons whose illegitimate privileges are threatened will stand by peacefully. It is true that I do not discuss here what legitimately may be done and what tactics would be best in such circumstances. Listeners hardly will be interested in such discussion until they accept the libertarian framework. Many particular criticisms have been made of the particular ends of writers in the utopian tradition and of the particular societies they describe, but two criticisms have seemed to apply to all. First, utopians want to make all of society over in accordance with one detailed plan, formulated in advance and never before approximated. They see as their object a perfect society, and hence they describe a static and rigid society with no opportunity or expectation of change or progress, and no opportunity for the inhabitants of the society themselves to choose new patterns. For if a change is a change for the better, then the previous state of the society, because surpassable, wasn't perfect. And if a change is a change for the worse, the previous state of society, allowing deterioration, wasn't perfect. And why make a change which is neutral? Second, utopians assume that the particular society they describe will operate without certain problems arising, that social mechanisms and institutions will function as they predict, and that people will not act from certain motives and interests. They blandly ignore certain obvious problems that anyone with any experience of the world would be struck by, or make the most wildly optimistic assumptions about how these problems will be avoided or surmounted. The utopian tradition is Maximax. We do not detail the character of each particular community within the society, and we imagine the nature and composition of these constituent communities changing over time. No utopian writers actually fix all of the details of their communities. Since details about the framework would have to be fixed, how does our procedure differ from theirs? They wish to fix in advance all of the important social details, leaving undetermined only the trivial details, about which they either don't care or which raise no interesting issues of principle. Whereas, in our view, the nature of the various communities is very important. These questions are so important that they should not be settled by anyone for anyone else. Do we, however, wish to describe in specific detail the nature of the framework, which is to be fixed in character and unchanging? Do we assume that the framework will operate without problems? I do wish to describe the kind of framework, namely one which leaves liberty for experimentation of varied sorts. Some writers try to justify a system of liberty as one that will lead to an optimal rate of experimentation and innovation. If the optimum is defined as that yielded by a system of liberty, the result is uninteresting, and if an alternative characterization of optimum is offered, it might be that it is best achieved by forcing people to innovate and experiment by taxing more heavily those who don't. The system we propose leaves room for such experimentation but does not require it. People are free to stagnate if they wish, as well as to innovate. But all of the details of the framework will not be set down in advance. It would be easier to do this than to design in advance the details of a perfect society. Nor do I assume that all problems about the framework are solved. Let us mention a few here. There will be problems about the role, if any, to be played by some central authority or protective association. How will this authority be selected, and how will it be ensured that the authority does and does only what it is supposed to do? The major role, as I see it, would be to enforce the operation of the framework. For example, to prevent some communities from invading and seizing others, their persons or assets. Furthermore, it will adjudicate in some reasonable fashion conflicts between communities which cannot be settled by peaceful means. What the best form of such a central authority is, I would not wish to investigate here. It seems desirable that one not be fixed permanently, but that room be left for improvements of detail. I ignore here the difficult and important problems of the controls on a central authority, powerful enough to perform its appropriate functions, because I have nothing special to add to the standard literature on federations, confederations, decentralization of power, checks and balances, and so on. One persistent strand in utopian thinking, as we have mentioned, is the feeling that there is some set of principles obvious enough to be accepted by all men of goodwill, precise enough to give unambiguous guidance in particular situations, clear enough so that all will realize its dictates, and complete enough to cover all problems which actually will arise. Since I do not assume that there are such principles, I do not assume that the political realm will wither away. The messiness of the details of a political apparatus and the details of how it is to be controlled and limited do not fit easily into one's hopes for a sleek, simple utopian scheme. Apart from the conflict between communities, there will be other tasks for a central apparatus or agency. For example, enforcing an individual's right to leave a community. But problems arise if an individual can plausibly be viewed as owing something to the other members of a community he wishes to leave. For example, he has been educated at their expense on the explicit agreement that he would use his acquired skills and knowledge in the home community. Or he has acquired certain family obligations that he will abandon by shifting communities. Or, without such ties, he wishes to leave. What may he take out with him? Or he wishes to leave after he's committed some punishable offense for which the community wishes to punish him. Clearly, the principles will be complicated ones. Children present yet more difficult problems, In some way, it must be ensured that they are informed of the range of alternatives in the world. But the home community might view it as important that their youngsters not be exposed to the knowledge that 100 miles away is a community of great sexual freedom, and so on. I mention these problems to indicate a fraction of the thinking that needs to be done on the details of a framework, and to make clear that I do not think its nature can be settled finally now either. We might, of course, try slightly different frameworks in different sections of a country, allowing each section to shift slightly their own framework as they see how the others work out. Still, across the board, there will be some common framework, though its particular character will not be permanently fixed. Even though the details of the framework aren't settled, won't there be some rigid limits about it, some things inalterably fixed? Will it be possible to shift to a non-voluntary framework, permitting the forced exclusion of various styles of life? If a framework could be devised that could not be transformed into a non-voluntary one, would we wish to institute it? If we institute such a permanently voluntary general framework, are we not, to some extent, ruling out certain possible choices? Are we not saying in advance that people cannot choose to live in a certain way? Are we setting a rigid range in which people can move, and thus committing the usual fault of the static utopians? The comparable question about an individual is whether a free system will allow him to sell himself into slavery. I believe that it would. Other writers disagree. It also would allow him permanently to commit himself never to enter into such a transaction. But some things individuals may choose for themselves, no one may choose for another. So long as it is realized at what a general level the rigidity lies, and what diversity of particular lives and communities it allows, the answer is, yes, the framework should be fixed as voluntary. But remember that any individual may contract into any particular constraints over himself, and so may use the voluntary framework to contract himself out of it. If all individuals do so, the voluntary framework will not operate until the next generation, when others come of age. How Utopia Works Out. Well, what exactly will it all turn out to be like? In what directions will people flower? How large will the communities be? Will there be some large cities? How will economies of scale operate to fix the size of the communities? Will all of the communities be geographical, or will there be many important secondary associations, and so on? Will most communities follow particular, though diverse, utopian visions, or will many communities themselves be open, animated by no such particular vision? I do not know, and you should not be interested in my guesses about what would occur under the framework in the near future. As for the long run, I would not attempt to guess. So is this all it comes to? Utopia is a free society? Utopia is not just a society in which the framework is realized, for who could believe that 10 minutes after the framework was established, we would have utopia? Things would be no different than now. It is what grows spontaneously from the individual choices of many people over a long period of time that will be worth speaking eloquently about. Not that any particular stage of the process is an end state which all our desires are aimed at. The utopian process is substituted for the utopian end state of other static theories of utopias. Many communities will achieve many different characters. Only a fool or a prophet would try to prophesy the range and limits and characters of the communities after, for example, 150 years of the operation of this framework. Aspiring to neither role, let me close by emphasizing the dual nature of the conception of utopia being presented here. There is the framework of utopia, and there are the particular communities within the framework. Almost all of the literature on utopia is, according to our conception, concerned with the character of the particular communities within the framework. The fact that I have not propounded some particular description of a constituent community does not mean that I think doing so is unimportant or less important or uninteresting. How could that be? We live in particular communities. It is here that one's non-imperialistic vision of the ideal or good society is to be propounded and realized. Allowing us to do that is what the framework is for. Without such visions impelling and animating the creation of particular communities with particular desired characteristics, the framework will lack life. Conjoined with many persons' particular visions, the framework enables us to get the best of all possible worlds. The position expounded here totally rejects planning in detail, in advance, one community in which everyone is to live, yet sympathizes with voluntary utopian experimentation and provides it with the background in which it can flower. Does this position fall within the utopian or the anti-utopian camp? My difficulty in answering this question encourages me to think the framework captures the virtues and advantages of each position. If instead it blunders into combining the errors, defects, and mistakes of both of them, the filtering process of free and open discussion will make this clear. Utopia and the Minimal State. The framework for utopia that we have described is equivalent to the minimal state. The argument of this chapter starts and stands independently of the argument of parts 1 and 2 and converges to their result, the minimal state, from another direction. In our discussion in this chapter, we did not treat the framework as more than a minimal state, but we made no effort to build explicitly upon our earlier discussion of protective agencies, for we wanted the convergence of two independent lines of argument. We need not mesh our discussion here with our earlier one of dominant protective agencies, beyond noting that whatever conclusions people reach about the role of a central authority, the controls on it, and so forth, will shape the internal form and structure of the protective agencies they choose to be the clients of. We argued in Part 1 that the minimal state is morally legitimate. In Part 2, we argued that no more extensive state could be morally justified, that any more extensive state would, will, violate the rights of individuals. This morally favored state, the only morally legitimate state, the only morally tolerable one, we now see is the one that best realizes the utopian aspirations of untold dreamers and visionaries. It preserves what we all can keep from the utopian tradition and opens the rest of that tradition to our individual aspirations. Recall now the question with which this chapter began. Is not the minimal state, the framework for utopia, an inspiring vision? The minimal state treats us as inviolate individuals who may not be used in certain ways by others as means or tools or instruments or resources. It treats us as persons having individual rights with the dignity this constitutes. Treating us with respect by respecting our rights, it allows us, individually or with whom we choose, to choose our life and to realize our ends and our conception of ourselves, insofar as we can, aided by the voluntary cooperation of other individuals possessing the same dignity. How dare any state or group of individuals do more or less? You've been listening to Anarchy, State, and Utopia by Robert Nozick, narrated by Don Hagen. If you've enjoyed this audiobook and this performance, then please visit our website, Gildan Media, GILDANMEDIA.com, where you'll find a wide selection of titles in business and finance, personal development, physiology, and much, much more. And thank you for being a Gildan audio listener.
This has been a Gildan audio production. For more affordable, life-changing audio programs, visit our website at gildanmedia.com.